When our stomach is out of balance and says you need calories, we have an urge to eat. When something else is unpleasant, like an emotion, and we eat to scratch that itch, suddenly those cravings become hard to differentiate. I have an urge and I eat. So that urge could be a homeostatic hunger, or we could have hedonic hunger, meaning we eat because of an emotion, not because we're actually hungry. Our feeling body is so much wiser and stronger than our thinking brain. What we need to do is start re-engaging, reuniting with our bodies, and our bodies are going to tell us everything.
That was Judd Brewer, and this is Mentally Flexible. Welcome to Mentally Flexible, where we have meaningful conversations to help you build mental flexibility. I'm Tom Parks. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and in each episode, I'll be talking to people who inspire me most on topics related to psychology, mental health, and creativity. My hope is that through these conversations, you'll better understand yourself, others, and the world around you. Thanks for being here, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Judd Brewer. Dr. Judd is a New York Times bestselling author, neuroscientist, addiction psychiatrist, and thought leader in the field of habit change. He is the director of research and innovation at Brown University's Mindfulness Center, where he also serves as an associate professor. He is the executive medical director of behavioral health at ShareCare Inc. and a research affiliate at MIT. Dr. Judd has developed and tested novel mindfulness programs for habit change, including treatments for smoking, emotional eating, and anxiety. His new book is called The Hunger Habit, Why We Eat When We're Not Hungry and How to Stop, which we discuss in this episode. Some of the more specific topics we explore include how all urges converge in one place in the brain, how our biological drives around food cause challenges in a modern context, the way we can use food to numb ourselves from difficult emotions, the healing potential of curiosity, challenges with mindless eating, and the difference between hunger and craving. Really great talking to Dr. Judd again. Last time he was on, we talked about his previous book on anxiety, and it's always amazing to get to speak with someone who knows so much about habit and mindfulness and how we make change in our lives. And I think you'll enjoy this one a lot. And yeah, sincere thank you for all your ongoing support and listening to the show. If you'd like to help the podcast in a more direct way, it'd be really cool if you could leave a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. That's always helpful in booking new guests. You could follow me on Instagram at Mentally Flexible and share with a friend if you think they'd be interested. And I hope you all have a really great day. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Judd Brewer. Good to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah, do you want to give a little bit of an overview on your new book? Just title and summary, and then we can dive into it a little more.
I'd be happy to. So it's called The Hunger Habit. And I wrote it for all the people who have struggled with their relationship with eating. So it's not just overeating. It could be type of food they're eating. It could be, you know, mindlessly eating. It could be stress eating. It could be eating out of emotion. You know, there's so many different ways that we form habits around eating. And we also form very unhealthy relationships with eating and ourselves. So this term that I didn't make up, but is commonly used, you know, where people make these food rules and then they put themselves in food jail. Where, you know, and they feel like there's something wrong with them if they can't follow their own food rules. And all of that is a myth. From a neuroscience standpoint, it's willpower is more myth than muscle. And so not only are they fed, and it's funny how many food analogies we use just when we talk, right? Not only are they fed this idea that they need to have more willpower, but they feel ashamed. They feel like there's something wrong with them when they can't follow the rules. And so they beat themselves up and they form habits of self-judgment, self-loathing, and just, you know, start to distance themselves from their bodies. So, you know, I wrote it for everybody that can raise their hand to any of these things, because they're all interrelated. And I think, you know, and this isn't even just a modern phenomenon. There's this great line from a short story that James Joyce wrote back in 1914, I think, called The Painful Case. And there was a character named Mr. Duffy. And he says, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how many of us walk around like this disembodied head, and then we use our weapons of mass distraction, our phones, whenever we're uncomfortable, we don't have good distress tolerance. You know, we can't tolerate distress. And so we get in these habits of distracting ourselves, whether it's our phones or food, just as two examples.
Yeah. And nowadays, both of those are just equally as accessible all the time to turn to.
Yes, you can use you can go on your phone to distract yourself, and you can even order food from your phone.
Go meta with it. Something that in the beginning of the book you talked about that said, I think it blew your brain, and it blew my brain even before I read that it blew your brain, was this discovery you had that all urges converge in one place. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yes. So urges converge. I love the alliteration there. The rhyme. So these urges converge in the sense that it's, you know, whether we have an urge to eat, whether we have an urge to distract ourselves, and also this even converges. What blew my mind was around how the urges to make pleasant things continue or get more pleasant things and to make unpleasant things go away, that is the same. And what I mean by that is we can have a craving for pleasant things, and we can have a craving for unpleasant things to go away. Craving. So we often think of craving as, I want something good. But craving's really about getting something that we want or making something go away that we don't want. And that urge feels the same. It says, do something, do something, do something. That was a mind blower for me.
Clinically, is that how we kind of decipher the addictions and compulsions?
Well, I would say it's a good question. With addiction, you know, the definition that I learned in residency and still use is continued use despite adverse consequences. And so I think that helps to bring that to the fore and articulate it a little bit more clearly, because we can see how things like food and social media start to fall into that spectrum.
Yeah. Interesting. Could you maybe just share a little bit more about the difficult places people end up in within their relationship to food that might make it, just some of the challenging places people end up in their relationships with food. Could you share a little bit more about that?
Sure. And I'll start with, you know, one end of the spectrum, and we can go run the spectrum if it's helpful.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of binge eating disorder, for example, which is at the far end of the spectrum, where people are, you know, eating not because they're hungry, but as a way to, as one of my patients put it, numb themselves often. And the way that works is, you know, this evolutionarily conserved survival mechanism, ironically, you know, this is for survival. It's set up through this, you know, there are three essential components, right? A trigger, a behavior, and a reward. And so we learn, you know, our ancient ancestors use this to help them remember where food is. You see food, there's the trigger. You eat the food, there's the behavior, and then your stomach sends this dopamine signal to your brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. So it's for developing memory of context. So we can remember the next day when we're in the cave to go back to the food source. In modern day, that is still at play, yet with our, you know, 24/7 availability of food, we don't have to remember where food is. We just have to remember where our phone is so we can order it or remember where our refrigerator is, which is pretty easy. So we've got that. And then our brain still has this mechanism kicking around. So it says, well, what else can I use this for? And so when we're stressed out, we learn there's the trigger. We learn, oh, if I eat something, I can distract myself. Might feel a little bit better for a moment. There's the behavior. And that actually the behavior is eating, and then the feeling a little bit better because we've distracted ourselves is the result or the reward. And that feeds back and forms stress eating habits. And at a far end of that spectrum, you know, we get binge eating disorder where the binging gets reinforced through whatever the you know the psychological mechanism of you know was to trigger it. So for example, one of my patients, she was about 30 when she came to see me and was binging on entire large pizzas 20 out of 30 days a month.
Wow.
Yeah. And the way she put it was that, you know, she'd had some emotional trauma when she was younger. And the only way she had learned as a kid when she was like 8 or 10 or something was to, you know, the only way she learned to cope with her emotions as an 8-year-old was to eat food. And so negative emotion triggers her to eat. And then she, you know, as she put it, she would numb herself. So it was very numbing. And she needed to, you know, for that to, because it's not really going to help what the underlying issue is. So it became this binge eating disorder because your body becomes, you know, tolerant. And it's like, well, you need to eat more food, you know, to distract yourself, you know, numb yourself more and more and more. Because if you're not actually cleaning, you know, think of it as a psychological wound. If you're not, if you don't know how to clean it out, it's not going to heal. You're just going to heap more and more Band-Aids on it and it's going to fester. And that was unfortunately what was happening for her.
So from a process level, is there a lot of overlap with that and how someone might relate to substances?
Yes, same process. Yeah. And I see this all the time in my clinic. You know, people turn to alcohol just like they might turn to food. And especially anxiety is a big one that I see because I specialize a lot in anxiety, where somebody's anxiety is driving them to drink, and that certainly can numb them. And then it forms that vicious cycle.
I don't know if you were going to get to this as we go through the spectrum so we can table it when we get there, but often what can show up associated with binging is purging. I don't know if you were going to talk to that about that at all.
I wasn't as much because bulimia nervosa isn't, you know, this book isn't written for somebody with anorexia or bulimia nervosa, but we can, you know, in short, and we can just kind of, you know, talk about this now, is the purging comes from this, you know, oh no, I just ate a bunch of calories. You know, this is oversimplifying it, but the general idea is, oh no, I ate a bunch of calories. I need to get rid of them. And so the binge purge cycle starts up. So a lot of people have binge eating disorder. They don't purge, but there are also a number of people who are, you know, who are like, oh man, I just put in 5,000 calories. You know, I need to get them out quickly.
Yes. And then sometimes too, I've seen with some clients then process that led to binging in the first place can start right back up with the distress that comes from purging. And then it can even happen subsequent to the purging. And that can be a really hard trap people fall into.
It can. And I've even seen this with this patient that I was talking about with the pizzas. She, because the only mechanism she knew to numb herself was binging, it wasn't every time, but often when she would finish a binge, she would feel guilty about binging, and that guilt could trigger another binge. So I think of this as like an echo binge, you know, where it's like, well, let's do it again. Because her body's like, I'm a one trick pony. This is all I know. So she really needed to learn how her mind worked so she could actually, you know, let go of the binging.
Yes.
And on top of that, Well, I should say underneath that, start the healing, clean out that wound.
Yes. Yeah. It's like in that moment, our awareness is so narrowed in on just one lane of behavioral responses that we lose the ability to step back and like understand more flexible ways of showing up. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a lot of this is about learning distress tolerance, you know, which in modern day, I think is everybody struggles with because of these, you know, our weapons of mass distraction, our phones, right? So, you know, people are going to their phones to distract themselves instead of learning that their emotions might be unpleasant, but their heads aren't going to explode if they have a strong emotion. A lot of people, you know, it's like, oh, this is unpleasant. Make it go away right now. You know, because our survival mechanisms say, hey, you know, bad, make it go away.
Yes.
But if we really look at it, it's like, oh, well, this is unpleasant. Okay. And if we open to it, we actually learn that we have all this internal strength and power, and it helps us like, oh, that's not so bad. What else can I tolerate that I might not have been able to tolerate before? You know, even look at discourse in society where, you know, people can't stand even sit and listen to somebody else's view if it's different than their own. That's crazy. That's going to tear our society apart.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And that's, I'm wondering how it could be applied in political discourse, but I'm sure there's a way. That's why clinically we often use exposure, right? Is like to voluntarily help somebody understand they can tolerate or accept or make space for things that are uncomfortable. It's like going to the gym for that process, right?
Yes. Yes. And I would say, you know, one thing that I never learned when I was learning exposure therapy in residency was the importance of curiosity, helping people develop curiosity as part of the attitudinal quality that comes with the exposure. So, you know, my what I remember, you know, my brain, you know, likes to use humor. So it's like, you know, lick the toilet, lick the toilet, lick the toilet, you know, if you have a germ phobia. And it's not that, but that's what I remember. But if we can be like, oh, what's this aversion to germs, you know, to the sink feel like? You know, like, oh, yes. How bad is it? You know, and that curiosity becomes that superpower to be able to start exploring. Like, what is it that feels so bad? And is this really, you know, is my arm going to fall off if I touch the sink? Well, let's see. Yes. Oh, wow, my arm didn't fall off. Cool. You know, and that, oh, is very, very different than the, oh no, this is, you know, this is terrible.
Yes. Yeah. It's the curiosity gives it a richness where you can actually learn rather than just sort of rushing through to get to the end goal of doing the exposure.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's more of that inhibitory learning model.
Yeah. And I'd be interested to see because, you know, the research, and this goes way back because exposure therapy is not new. But the dropout rates are huge, both in the studies and clinically. And so, you know, and I'm sure people are doing this, so, you know, kudos to them. But imagine if curiosity was at the top of the list, like training people in curiosity first. I mean, we all have it, so it's really helping them awaken that curiosity. So imagine if we started there and say, hey, here are the warm-up exercises, is let's go work, you know, help you develop your curiosity superpower for 2 weeks, and then we're going to actually start the exposure therapy. I would hypothesize that you're going to get a much lower dropout rate.
Totally. And I think something close to what you're talking about is how I work with clients. And there's a lot of people integrating ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, with exposure and response prevention, where what I do with clients is much more tying exposures to something actually valuable and meaningful in your life, rather than it feeling like these arbitrary things that you're just working up a hierarchy on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even there, you know, I think somebody should nobody needs to start yet another therapy. It seems like a new one comes around every 10 years. But I'd love to see, and I think acceptance and commitment therapy does this to some degree, but it's not explicit to my knowledge. It's been a while since I trained in it. But like, hey, let's develop curiosity therapy as an adjunct to every therapy.
Yes.
You know, and like, I wouldn't even call it therapy. I'd call it training. Let's train everyone in curiosity. You know, that's going to help the world, you know, because this is where political discourse, right? Imagine instead of going, oh no, they're of the X, you know, they're of the opposite, whatever, go, oh, huh. Let me really try to understand where they're coming from and truly mean it, not just be like, I'm going to wait 30 seconds and then try to inject my opinion.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with you. And yeah, I think ACT maybe could do a better job in being more explicit with it, but I think it's in there, at least when I teach it. And you and I are both people who appreciate meditation and mindfulness, and curiosity is sort of just a foundational piece of mindfulness, right? It's like when you sit down and you just open up from a place of curiosity, that's like the essence of being mindful.
Absolutely. I don't even, you know, mindfulness, because it is a concept, it means that it is subject to interpretation and we have to grok it as a concept. So what if we just place that concept off to the side and get to the heart of the experiential elements? You know, so I think of it as awareness and curiosity. I don't use the word mindfulness unless somebody asks about it. I say, hey, you know, let's get curious, you know, and that's, you know, that's the heart of it. So we don't even need to try to understand, well, what's mindfulness? Like, we all know what curiosity is.
Yes. Let's notice what's here with some curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess move in across that spectrum. So we talked about one of the challenging ways people can end up relating to food is within binge eating. What are some others?
So binge eating is one. I think, you know, let's take the opposite. I mean, it's probably not the opposite, but something farther away, which is eating mindlessly, right? So mindless eating, I mean, you know, it could be snacking. It could be somebody eating a snack while they watch a movie or watch television. I see this so much where they've just associated, oh, it's nighttime, you know, winding down with a movie or a television show. They've just eaten dinner. They're not hungry, but it's like, oh, popcorn, ice cream, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Don't be so personal here, Judd.
I was trying to not reveal identities. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, a big part of my journey has been trying to increase mindful awareness into eating, because something happens where I just almost feel like my dog just when food's in front of me, and I can really lose like spacious awareness around that process. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a bit of what you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, it comes back to just these learned associations. I remember vividly the taste and the smell of movie popcorn when I was a freaking kid. You know, it was such a treat to go see a movie, especially a matinee, because I was a kid. We didn't get to go to the night movies. So we go to the movie theater, and what does it smell like? Popcorn, you know? And, you know, this treat of the big bucket of... Actually, now that I think I'm recalling what it's like to eat movie theater popcorn now, where you're like, how much butter do you want? And they're like, pump, 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 pump. And we're like, don't stop, don't stop, don't stop.
Yeah, it's so true, right?
Yeah. So it's like I reach into the bucket and it's like a handful of butter with the popcorn as the butter delivery vehicle, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, and it's like I'm licking up to my elbow because it's so, so full of butter. So I remember that association, and it's a very positive one, because I think I saw Star Wars. I don't remember. Did I see Star Wars? Probably. I was born in the 70s. So it was like, I think I actually got to see Star Wars in the movie theater, the drive-thru, or something crazy, where it's like, you know, nothing's going to top that, right? I don't care how, you know, the special effects of modern movies, nothing for me, nothing's, it was just perfect time of life and the perfect movie plots and everything. Oh my God. And then you add in the popcorn and my head's going to explode with joy. Right. But if I think about like, okay, that was joyful. If I even think about that bucket of butter, I mean, popcorn now, my stomach turns. I'm like, I can't believe I actually didn't throw up.
Yes.
You know, cause it's so disgusting if I think about it. But those are the associations we make. And then if we don't pay attention, we relax at night, we eat some popcorn when we're not hungry, and then we don't sleep well, but it's, we don't make that association. Oh, that was extra food on top of what I needed, and I haven't given my body that time to rest and digest, to let it sleep well. And so we know clinically, we know scientifically that eating a bunch of food before bedtime is not helpful, especially if we're not hungry, if we don't need the calories. Yet it's hard to make that association because we're going to sleep. So yes, we don't get the feedback. And in the morning, we're like, oh, I didn't sleep well. And then we start making up stories. Well, maybe I was stressed the previous day. Maybe I blah, blah, blah. And then we look to all of our electronics and be like, tell me why I didn't sleep well. Well, we could just ask our bodies. And our body's like, dude, you didn't need that popcorn. You know?
Yes.
It's pretty straightforward.
Totally. Yeah. It's something I'm not embarrassed to admit. It's just a phrase, but something that I learned, my wife helped me learn many years ago, was that there's a difference between being hungry and wanting to eat. Those things had just always been conflated for me.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually dedicate a chapter to this in the book. In the Hunger Habit, I talk about meeting our needs versus feeding our wants. And a big piece of that is, you know, we often think that self-indulgence is self-care. It's not. That's why there are two different terms, right?
Yes, yes.
And so we're like, well, I deserve this. I'm going to celebrate. I'm going to whatever. We associate food with, you know, celebrations. And
yes.
It goes back to all the parties in childhood, you know, the birthday parties and whatever. And for those of us that had the privilege to do that, not everybody got to do that. But for those of us that, and food is love, right? So so many families, different cultures, et cetera. It's like, here's, you know, the grandparents are like, here's their expression of love. And if you don't eat it, you don't love them.
Yes. Yeah. You know?
And so all of these associations around food come to the fore. And so that piece comes in where we just get so stuck in those cycles. It's not even funny.
Mm. Yeah. And so a way to think about that is the difference between hunger and cravings is a way we could boil that down.
Yes. Yes. Because certainly we need love, right? If you think of Maslow's hierarchy, you know, you've got to meet your basic needs and then you'd need to meet your emotional needs. So what do I need, you know, is very different than what do I want? And so the self-indulgence, if it's a, hey, I'm going to indulge, I'm going to quote unquote, take care of myself by celebrating, by eating, is not actually meeting our needs. We can, because we don't need the calories, right? And so if we're really truly meeting our needs, we can ask ourselves, well, what do I need? Well, I need to celebrate, right? This is wonderful. And we don't need to celebrate by eating. That's just an association that we've made. And so we can step back and say, you know, what's a great way to celebrate? Well, let's get some seltzer water, you know, if it's nighttime or something, instead of like, hey, let's break out the champagne. You know, there are lots of creative ways that we can celebrate and while meeting our needs, right? So that indulging of that want just feeds cycles if we're not asking, hey, what's really taking care of myself? So self-indulgence is very different than self-care. In that sense.
Mm. Why do people, I mean, I know from my own journey, but I'm curious what you think is like, why do you think it's hard to decipher the difference between being hungry and craving? They feel very similar. Is it just lack of awareness and work on being in tune with the differences of those experiences and having different names for them and really paying attention?
Yes. And I've seen this over and over and over. And I write a little bit about this in The Hunger Habit, where I was working, doing group medical visit with a bunch of women, it happened to be all women at the time, who were struggling with binge eating disorder. And so we'd come together, you know, as a group once a week to help them start to understand and work with the binge eating. And it took me about a month when I started this group to realize that I was missing something. I couldn't put my finger on it. And in one meeting, a woman said, well, I have an urge and I eat. And I just assumed, I had previously assumed that people eat when they're hungry. And so I said, wait a minute, tell me more about that. And she said, well, I said, you know, is it you're talking about when you're hungry? And she said, no, I just have an urge and I eat. And then I started asking, like, well, how do you know when you're hungry versus when you're bored or sad or lonely or it's an emotion? And she looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, hunger versus emotion. And so suddenly everybody in the room is like, yeah. Let's double click on this. This is, you know, cause so we got at the heart of the problem, which was I hadn't realized that they had totally dissociated actual hunger from the earth, you know, from they were basically dissociating from their, I don't want to use the word dissociation. So let's just say they had lost the ability to pay attention to their bodies to see if they were actually hungry. And so yes. The idea was any little unpleasant thing. So hunger is designed to be unpleasant because it says, hey, go get, you're not in balance. You need to go get some food. That's called homeostatic hunger, right? You're out of balance, get back in balance. So it's supposed to be unpleasant, right? That's where dopamine comes in as a motivation molecule. You know, it's not a pleasure molecule, as the internet says. Let me repeat that in case anybody missed that. Dopamine is not a pleasure molecule, despite the internet myths about it. It's really a motivation molecule. It shouldn't be pleasurable because if we're happy, if we're, you know, we're in balance. So dopamine says you're out of balance, go make yourself get it back in balance. That's why it's a motivation molecule. That's why it's about wanting. It's about anticipation. It's not about joy or pleasure. So when our stomach is out of balance and says you need calories, we have an urge to eat. When something else is unpleasant, like an emotion, and we eat to scratch that itch, suddenly those cravings become hard to differentiate. I have an urge and I eat. So that urge could be a homeostatic hunger, or, and this term is relatively modern because of this problem with food, is we could have hedonic hunger, meaning we eat because of an emotion, not because we're actually hungry. So homeostatic hunger is a physiologic, helpful survival mechanism. Hedonic hunger, ironically, is anti-survival, because it's not good for our health to eat when we're not hungry. And those two get mushed together because that urge, you know, I have an urge and I eat, I have an urge and I eat. So we needed to, in that group, we needed to start with that basic premise to help people start getting back in touch with their bodies. They've been divorced from their bodies because anything unpleasant, you know, make it go away. That's that distress tolerance or intolerance, distress intolerance. And so they needed to start to learn, you know, what it was like to re-inhabit their bodies, to befriend themselves. Because our bodies are so wise. You know, I think of it this way. Our feeling body is so much wiser and stronger than our thinking brain. We think that we know everything. Well, we can look at a lot of things up on the internet, and some of them are true. I would say most of it is true. But here we know what we quote unquote need to do, but we can't do it because we think there's something wrong with us. But the truth is what we need to do is start kind of re-engaging, reuniting with our bodies so that we can listen to our bodies, and our bodies are going to tell us everything.
Wow. That's super powerful. Yeah. A lot of things boil down to that, right? Like reconnecting with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on that point, those different types of hunger, it's super interesting. Because with something else like alcohol, we never need to drink. And so if you're at a party and feeling anxious and then you find yourself kind of compulsively turning to go get a drink, you're able to kind of connect the dots how this uncomfortable feeling's leading to it. Mm-hmm. But with food, for some reason, because we do need food in our lives, when something uncomfortable shows up and we in the same way turn towards food, there's this way we can get tricked into that being a need rather than something we're doing to escape an uncomfortable feeling.
Yes. And that's where this feeding our want, it gets, calls itself meeting our needs. Oh, I need this. No, you don't need alcohol to survive. In fact, if you drink too much alcohol, you're going to get a vitamin B12 deficiency. And that's something that you do need. So it's very clear physiologically that we don't need alcohol to survive. It might feel like, oh, if I'm not going to survive this party without a drink.
Yeah.
But that's very different than I really truly need this. And for people who can learn distress tolerance, you know, again, this comes back to curiosity and kindness to ourselves, we can realize, oh, this is a social lubricant, alcohol, for example. And, you know, what if I substitute curiosity? Maybe curiosity can be my social lubricant, both with myself. Like, oh, what does it feel like to be nervous? What does it feel like to have all these thoughts going through my head? Like, oh, you know, are people going to judge me? Or all the things that we do to kind of make ourselves nervous in think our, you know, psych ourselves out when it comes to social anxiety. I'm not saying that it's easy. There's a lot of social anxiety out there. It's a really challenging thing for a lot of people. And we're actually doing some work now with some collaborators to see how much we can bring some of these programs forward to help people with social anxiety, you know, like our Unwinding Anxiety app, for example. And it's amazing how, you know, this basic premise of, you know, the idea is, well, if we can train people to learn how their minds work, they can learn to work with their minds and be able to bring strength to these situations instead of turning to eating or drinking or whatever it is that they've used in the past.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts about being a therapist is so many people have never given themselves an hour of time without any distractions with their phone or something else, just to sit down and be invited to be curious about what's going on inside of them. And it's just like one of the coolest things is to provide a space for somebody to do that. It's always a first step to healing.
Absolutely. And I'm laughing because there was a study published in Science a few years ago now, probably more than five now, where the researchers said, well, let's see how bad it is for people. Like, the therapist provides the space, and you might know this study, but I'll just highlight it because it is amazing, where they said, okay, we're going to give you 15 minutes alone without your technology, and, you know, just so you can sit and think or whatever. And so they did a series of studies basically with that simple premise, and people absolutely went nuts. They're like, you know, they're like, this is terrible. And the researchers were so incredulous at some of their early findings, they replicated to them and then said, okay, let's see how far this goes. And they said, we will give you the option to shock yourself. Like, and they calibrated this electric shock to it to a point where it was painful. And they said, you can press this button to shock yourself or you can just sit there. And of course, I don't want to, there was a sex difference. More men chose to do this than women, so people can draw their own conclusions there. But a surprisingly large number of people would prefer to shock themselves, like painful shock, than sit there and just be with themselves.
Whoa.
Crazy.
Well, yeah, it kind of draws this attention towards this weird paradox where, on the one hand, people will choose to go sit by themselves in a cave. I don't know how many people are actually meditating in caves, but that's what we say. Meditate alone for long chunks of time. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, being alone by yourself in a prison surrounded by not great stuff happening on is like the worst thing you can do to somebody. It's because what does that boil down to? It's just how people relate to their own inner experience, right? Or even the minds more specifically.
Yes. I mean, look at Nelson Mandela, who I don't know how long he spent in solitary confinement in prison, but he was in prison like, what, 27 years long? I don't know. Ask the internet. Hopefully it's accurate. So long time. And he could have come out bitter, angry, you know, beaten down, demoralized, but he came out so beautifully, you know, like resilient and even, I don't know, you know what his situation was beforehand, but he's a beautiful example of kind of taking what you've got and maximizing that for mental development. I mean, this is just a beautiful story of coming out and literally changing a country and helping to change the world in that respect as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah, similar to Viktor Frankl, right? Similar type of story. Yes. Answer true meaning. So we covered some of the challenging ways people can relate to food. And I think what we led into is one of the first steps to healing this or changing it is to, one, identify the habitual nature of it and to bring some genuine curiosity and awareness to the habit, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Anything else you want to say there? Or like, where do we move into after that? Like, is where do we go after that?
Yeah, concretely, and I spell this out more in detail in The Hunger Habit, but the idea is, you know, first we've got to recognize what habit we're in. And it could be simply just noticing, okay, am I eating because I'm bored, stressed, lonely, or actually hungry? And we can also add in, you know, overeating. I was a member of the Clean Plate Club as a kid, you know, one of four raised by a single mom. So we, you know, when the food was on the table, it was a race to get as much as we could. And so, and then, you know, I'm not going to waste any food. So, you know, whatever the habit is, just recognizing it, like, oh, here's my whatever, and naming it and being able to see it when it emerges. The second step is really focused on leveraging the strength of our brain. So instead of relying on this with this myth of willpower, we can start to ask, and if people, you know, like, well, willpower, I just ask, how well did that work for you in the past? And generally they have all the information they need. So
it's true.
It's why it's called yo-yo dieting. It's not called successful dieting. It's called yo-yo dieting, right? Because we deprive ourselves. We think that, oh, this is, you know, this is working, and then it stops working, and we think there's something wrong with us. We just need more willpower. And the truth is, it's more myth than muscle. So realizing that willpower is not the answer, mostly people from their own experience, and then just asking the simple question, well, how does my brain work? The way that our brains work is if something's rewarding, we're going to keep doing it. If it's not rewarding, we're going to stop. This is this basic positive and negative reinforcement piece. And if you double down on the neuroscience, or these two researchers with Scorla and Wagner that came up with this formula in the 70s that's still used today because it's so powerful. And basically that says, you know, you've got to pay attention while you do something. And if it's more rewarding than you remembered, you get what's called a positive prediction error. You get a dopamine spritz and you learn, hey, do that more. If it's less rewarding than expected, you get a negative prediction error, dopamine spritz, you learn, hey, stop doing that. So for example, we did a study with our Eat Right Now app where we had people pay attention as they overate. They only took 10 to 15 times of people paying attention to realize, wait a minute, this is not rewarding. That reward value drops below zero and they shift their behavior. So there's that negative prediction error in play in real time. And there's also you can use the positive prediction error. So for example, for me, and I use this example in the book, I used to be addicted to eating gummy worms. And so I started paying attention. Long story short, gummy worms don't taste very good for me. And so they actually taste, I can't stomach eating gummy worms anymore. So completely disenchanted by paying attention to what it was like. And then also comparing them to what it's like to eat blueberries. I love blueberries. So I have no stock in blueberry companies, but I'll just say blueberries are nature's answer to my prayers for sweet things.
Yes.
And so there I'm leveraging that positive prediction error where it's like, wow, this is better than, you know, expected. So I get this huge differential between gummy worms and blueberries. And so there I can ask that simple question, what am I getting from this? And with gummy worms, it's like nothing. I become disenchanted. No willpower needed, right? Willpower is not even in the neuroscience equations. So there's leveraging the strength of my brain. And then also when I pay attention to what it's like to eat blueberries, and not too many of them, right? Because my brain's like, hey, you've got enough fiber, you're full, whatever. I get that positive prediction error that says blueberries, they're a great treat for dessert or when you're feeling you want something sweet and you don't need to eat too many of them. And so that's the whole of it. You know, one, map out the habit loop. Two, ask, what am I getting from this? And pay attention. And so if it's not rewarding, we're gonna become disenchanted. And then we can remember that. I call that building up our disenchantment database. So we're going to remember that over and over. And it's easier to recall it before we do it in the future. And then the third piece, it's really 2A or 2B, is if something, it's like stopping when we're full feels better than overeating, now we've got what I call the bigger, better offer. And our brain's going to say, hey, do that again, which could be don't eat so much. Or it could be, you know, blueberries over gummy worms.
Wow, that's so fascinating. Were you going to say something else? I didn't mean to.
Well, I was trying to remember, there's a Japanese term that is cultural. So it's interesting. I think it's Harihachibu, if I remember correctly, which means eating to like 80% of full.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that in that Blue Zones documentary. Did you watch that at all?
No, but I will now need to watch that because that's a cultural thing that they have learned that there's the bigger, better offer of, hey, it feels better to eat until you're 80% full than not to. And it wasn't like they're like, well, I want to maximize my longevity, and so therefore I'm going to eat until it. That's totally intellectual, and you can retrospectively go find these Blue Zones and ask what people are doing. Culturally, for I don't know how many, you know, hundreds of years, I'm making this up, you know, long time, thousands maybe, where people are like, yeah, this feels better to eat 80% as compared to 100%. And lo and behold, they're in a Blue Zone because it's not magic. This is very healthy. Yes. A healthy way to live. Yeah, where's the willpower in that? It's not. It's just rewarding. You know, it's rewarding to do it.
Yeah, it's like intergenerational wisdom rather than knowledge that you're trying to like squeeze down.
Yes.
Yeah, everything you just described about that is so important. And it made me realize that I think you actually played an important role in me changing my relationship to food even before you wrote this book, because I remember many years ago hearing you talk about that very same thing, but helping people stop smoking, about really paying attention to what it's like smoking a cigarette and how you feel after. And I remember applying that same method to how I felt eating or overeating and just really paying attention to how much I don't like that sensation. And now the awareness kicks in like at the start of a meal, just sort of like being aware of how this is going to play out and at what point do I that start to change. So thank you for that.
That's wonderful to hear. And it's funny, your story began the same way, excuse me, as my research exploration into eating, because as an addiction psychiatrist and a neuroscientist, I was very interested in helping people with addictions. And we had developed this app for smoking after some of our initial studies where we got like five times the quit rates of gold standard treatment for smoking cessation. And this app, this Crave and Quit app, we were pilot testing it, and pilot testers were saying, hey, you know, I'm changing my eating habits. And I assumed that they were eating more because that's what people typically do. And they said, no, I'm stopping my snacking using these same techniques. And that was a light bulb moment for me to go and look at eating and seeing that this whole underlying process is about positive and negative reinforcement. So it's interesting you mention the exact same thing that got me on the trail of actually exploring this, because it's the same. This habit formation process is the same, whether it's a cigarette, whether it's eating, or even anxiety, which was another, you know, we've talked about this before, so I won't go into it, but that was one of the most important things I never learned in medical school, was that anxiety can actually be driven like a habit. And that led down the whole path of writing the Unwinding Anxiety book.
Very cool. Well, I know we're getting towards the end here. Maybe it'd be helpful to, because I really think anybody who struggles with their relationship to food could benefit from this. And you mentioned in there too, and just to put out there, people with more serious eating disorders should definitely seek a qualified clinician. So this book wouldn't be enough for that. It could be a good adjunct, but maybe just to give people a little insight. It's pretty cool how you wrote the book, because there's like steps, like practical steps to follow do you want to just share a little bit about what people could find in the book as they go through it?
Sure. So the practical steps are, one, you know, map out your eating habit loop, you know, and whatever that is, there are so many different ones. Two, the simplest way to think of this, and this is where the orbital frontal cortex and all this reward value stuff comes in. But number two is just ask yourself, what am I getting from this? And then number three, I think of it as finding the bigger, better offer. That's the third part of the book, where we can learn to develop curiosity and kindness as our superpowers.
Oh, beautiful. Well, I'll be releasing this right around when the book comes out, and congrats again for doing this, and thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Until next time.
Indeed.
It's got me out of my mind. It's got me seeing trees breathe. It's got me learning how heaven and hell are both inside of me. It's got me feeling the love that I bottled so deep, when the entire world kept feeding on my greed. I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Yes, I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul. Oh yes, I know I'll never know. But I can close my eyes, take a deep breath, and try to open my soul.